Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and the Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening today.
Welcome to The Gays Are Revolting, a definitive weekly news source for contemporary gays.
We put the G in LGBTQIA+, and we're here to help you be the best G you can be.
You can follow us on Instagram at GaysRevoltingPod or join our Facebook group at The Gays Revolting.
Hey everyone!
Hey!
Another week in the studio. We're down a member. We don't have Tom. He's off doing something more important, probably.
Must be.
But we are joined by the How to Identify as Queer Starter Pack, Mikey.
Oh, thank you.
He's got the piercings. He's got the part-time drag. Oh. And also the honorary winner of the I Promise I'm Not Racist Award.
Oh.
It's Kyle.
What? Okay.
I don't know. I'm just on a white person.
Here we go.
This week. And filling in for Tom, we are actually joined by Adolfo Aranjuez.
That's pretty good, actually.
That's a bit of Filipina pride coming through there.
Hey.
Who's filling in this week, so thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How's it going, Adolfo? Nice to have you.
Yeah, okay. welcome.
It's really nice being here. I don't know if your listeners know where you are, but we have to walk through some very, very mask paraphernalia.
Yes.
Getting here. I felt very attacked. Also, the mic is very close to my face, so I feel like doubly attacked.
Oh.
I feel great.
For those that don't know, we record in a
like
scooter
a workshop.
Repair workshop.
Yeah.
And then they've got the studio inside.
It's like the room of requirement.
I went to the bathroom and it's very, very...
It's very confronting.
It has a musk.
Yeah,
It's very much like kind of envelops you.
It's that welcoming.
It's called character.
Okay. I mean, I'm turned on. Like, sorry, just to clarify.
It's an amazing studio.
So Adolfo, you're a Melbourne-based queer writer, editor, public speaker, and also a dancer. I think we're going to find it super difficult to keep the episode under an hour if we're discussing all your achievements. I mean, I woke up today and my biggest achievement was feeding my cat. Why are you so overachieving and making the rest of us look bad?
No, I'm not like trying to make anyone feel bad. I think the short answer is that I'm just doing the things that I love.
That's good.
But I just like love a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the actual like dark response to that question is that I didn't really have any friends as a baby.
Yeah.
I was my parents' like trophy.
Mm-hmm.
My psych and I talk about this a lot, and it's that I associate achievement with affection.
Okay.
This is like really, really heavy.
Wow,
for, like, the
we
first,
got
like,
in.
Two
we
minutes went... of your podcast. But yeah, like, so I think, yeah, I formed my sense of self based on my achievements. Like, for context.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were talking about like where we are in the space, like right now. My childhood bedroom obviously has four walls.
Mm-hmm.
Three of those walls were all filled up with like framed like awards and medals and certificates and stuff. That was just like, that
That's
was my childhood.
Crazy.
So the fact that I had that many to literally like fill up the walls.
Wow.
Kind of highlights for you like why I am this abnormal human right now.
Humble brag. No.
I am all about the brag. Like, not even humble. Like,
that's great.
No,
own it.
I used to just stick my boogers on the wall as a
ew.
Kid.
That is my.
Why?
No, I just like flick them.
You still do that. We have to ask you to stop.
So let's start with your film background. You're currently the editor of Metro, Australia's oldest film and media magazine. So tell us a little bit about the role that you do there and what sort of draws you to writing about cinema?
Okay, so just a bit of backstory on Metro, I guess. Metro has been running since 1963, so it's hella old. Wow. It's like older than me. It's like almost as old as my mom.
Yeah. Wow. Tom.
It's no.
Who is I refuse this mysterious to Tom?
You're Tom.
The 200th issue of that magazine is coming out actually in about a week's time from when this airs, which is pretty great. That's great. That was hellish to put together, not because of the job itself, but because I decided to put a bunch of extra material into that special commemorative edition.
Yeah.
But I stupidly didn't expand the production schedule, which meant I was working to like a normal issue's length, but doing like a bunch of stuff. Anyway, but it's amazing doing that 200th issue. And so you probably gathered from that. My role there is both curatorial and copy editing combined. I'm the head honcho, like really. I'm like a nicer Meryl Streep.
Yeah, love it.
I mean, like, don't get me wrong, I'm very like cutthroat and like outcome focused as well, but I get things done. So what do I love about film? Like, film is great. I think my love for film really stems from the fact that it's the first truly immersive art form that's facilitated by technology. You know, like, obviously you can get a similar kind of feeling from listening to music or, you know, going to see a play or whatever, but you know, having all of your senses like activated at the one time never really happened before cinema. And even just like from the history of it, like if you think of the first time, you know, one of the first times a film was publicly screened, the Lumiere brothers, The Arrival of a Train, like people were freaked out that the train was actually coming at them. Like, that's amazing. Sorcery. But like, but that emphasizes the way, like when we enter that like sacred space of the cinema or even the sacred space of your lounge room, like with the lights off.
Not that sacred.
Lights dimmed, sexual and non-sexual. Yeah. So coupled with that love of like film itself, I think writing about film is really powerful because you can really kind of pull your reader into to that specific form. And film criticism itself is a very kind of uniquely positioned way of writing because you're not just, you know, arguing for a point. You're not just telling a story. It's kind of like both.
Yeah. And it's so personal as well. It's like films mean a lot of different things to different people. Like the Bee Movie, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just a perfect example.
Incredible example of filmmaking. But to write about film is quite difficult because you either have to go one way where you're purely technical and looking at like the construction of this film is quite poor, or going the complete opposite direction and saying emotionally this impacted and resonated with me because of my own experiences and that's why I think it's a great film. And then there's the weirdos in between, the Lars von Trier's and things that kind of do a little bit of both, that you're like, it's kind of technically shit, but
there's something
a
about
lot.
It.
And yeah, it's just like, it boggles my mind to write about film. Also, speaking of magazines, you're also editor-in-chief of Archer. A couple of my friends have actually written and submitted articles for it. It's probably the most inclusive sexuality-wise and gender publication that I've seen in like a mainstream sense. Like we have it at reception at our practice, for example, that has kind of crossed over. Could you tell us a little bit of how you came into that role and what is important to you that Archer like represents and the queer content that it sort of provides us?
I really like this narrative about, or this anecdote about it having crossed over and it's in your reception of your workplace, because that's kind of the point that we really wanted to do with that magazine, is to kind of reach out to people beyond, you know, our own communities. Like, obviously it's good to produce something that people from your own community will pick up and feel, you know, enlightened by or happy about, but to really reach out and bridge that gap between, you know, our communities and the kind of wider population is really important to us. I was thinking about this the other day and it kind of resonates with this question that you're asking. There's nothing more effective at changing someone's like heart and mind than a good story. And Archer is all about the personal essay and, you know, creative storytelling rather than, you know, argument or, you know, theory. And of course there's like a time and place for theory. I'm a massive nerd, obviously, as we've established by this point. And in other places I write precisely like that. But there's a very specific kind of bravery and empathy that you build when you write a personal essay.
Yeah.
Like, to clarify, I only work on the print magazine. The online kind of counterpart is a bit more eclectic in what it publishes, but the print magazine is very, very much like high creative nonfiction. And there's always heavy-handed stuff interspersed in the personal narratives, but everything is hinged on or anchored on someone's personal experiences, and using that experience as a lens, you know, from which you can broaden out and broach a bigger, heavier, scarier, sadder issue. So my role there is very similar to Metro's. I work with authors. I'm much more involved than Metro in the sense that they're not always professional writers, or they're not even aspiring writers. They're just people with a really interesting perspective to offer. And so we guide them through that process of working with an idea, how to tell the story, who exactly is your audience, like who are you telling this to? If they get a bit too specific, we make it more accessible, etc.
Yeah, it's a great publication because there is a lot of talk about print dying.
Yeah.
And the pushback from that is you do pick up a lot of these magazines and it feels like a 40-page advertisement that you've picked up. Arch is really great because it does just feel like curated content.
Yeah.
It's actually something you could go and buy and put on your coffee table and not be upsold bikinis. Yeah. Or, you know,
we do have bikini content on occasion. just putting it out there.
But yeah, it's really great. So I really appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks to your work for buying a coffee. Yeah.
Well, you should see, it's so funny because I work in a psych practice and the audience that we have at a psych practice isn't limited to a certain demographic.
Yeah.
It's not like we're just getting Northside queer people coming in. We have 60-year-olds that are transitioning into their like post-career life in, and then like 14-year-olds who are struggling with school stress. So having a certain selection of publications there, that it's a tightrope balance of what is suitable, but also what do you want to open up people to. But it's always funny when you see like a 60-year-old man that's coming in, you know, pick it up.
Yeah, yeah. We have some nudity in some
like goodness.
And just the abject fear of like, oh, I've committed to picking up this magazine. I've opened it.
It's like going through Twitter on public transport.
Oh, fuck yeah.
But the thing is, like, once you've started reading someone's story, like, it's kind of really hard to put it down. Yeah. Like, once you're halfway through, you know, maybe you feel a little bit confronted, a little bit uneasy.
Yeah.
But you have to know what happened.
That's it.
Yeah. It's just like reading. It's like a fairy tale. That's what you want. Do they get saved or whatever?
You've also got a memoir piece coming out in August for the Growing Up Queer in Australia anthology. You detail you moved here from the Philippines as an international student when you were 15. Funny, I also moved to Australia when I was 15.
Welcome.
Could you give us any sneak peeks of your piece or even your experience moving to Australia as a teen?
Yeah, so the piece is called Coming Out, Coming Home.
Yeah.
And I guess if you kind of infer from that, the piece is kind of weaving my process of like establishing myself here, finding my feet with that process of coming out or embracing my sexuality and gender identity.
Yeah.
It's kind of the more human half or kind of complement to an essay that I have published already in Mianjin.
Okay.
The cover essay is my essay on queerness or queering. Heavily theoretical, that one. But they broach the same idea, which is that when you're struggling with your sense of self, you are ultimately finding like a home in that kind of designation or, you know, the way that society sees you. You know, there are pitfalls in the way we discuss notions of identity and also like the transition from one culture to another.
Yeah.
Because when you think about these things, they're really, really like rooted in the language and the culture that you're arguing from. And notions of sexuality in particular are very different in the Philippines than they are in Australia or in English-speaking countries in general.
Yeah.
There's this term, which is what would be designated to me is bakla. And it's quite difficult to translate in English because there isn't like a direct kind of counterpoint. And a lot of like studies and, you know, like people have done their PhDs on this. But depending on context and who you're talking to and who you're looking at and talking about, it can span anything from what we in the West would call a trans woman to just like a cis gay male.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it just means any of those things. And so that kind of, that's interwoven with my coming to terms with what it means to be queer in Australia. Moving here at 15 was very hard. It wasn't my decision. It was my parents' decision. In brief, like TLDR, they basically wanted me to leave Manila.
Okay.
Yeah. They were just like, there's no future for you here. You're a waste. Are because you... trophy child.
Yeah.
So we should like get you out. Kick you off to you know, a Western country. So I'm one of those like dirty economic migrants. I literally was not escaping any hardship. I was one of those people who have stolen your jobs. So like, you know, whatever.
Me too.
My Filipino family would fight your
Oh my god, I'm sorry. What, for the jobs? Or for like so they paraded me through like a bunch of American cities to begin with. So we tried like the West Coast.
Yeah.
And then we went to the East Coast.
Yeah.
And none of those like felt like home. And then we went to Sydney, so like nothing happened. Sorry.
Not biased at all.
Oh my God.
I love it. We don't have a live show coming up in Sydney.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's fine. We
love our Sydney listeners. Don't listen to Adolfo.
I'm not a permanent host. It's fine. Yeah. Y'all can send me hate mail. Yeah, it just didn't feel right. Like, I'm sure there's stuff for other people in Sydney, but I didn't feel
it's
connected
to them.
To it. Yeah, good for them. Yeah. And then we went to Melbourne because my sister was getting married. She was already here for her master's.
Okay.
And I was just like, hey, why is this not on the list? Like, he's separating me from my sister. Also, like, stupid. Like, of course that should have been on the list because she was here. Yeah. So it was nice of them to, like, give me the chance to pick
we'll give
a
you
place.
The option.
At
yeah,
least.
For sure.
But yeah, like, it was kind of hard for me because, you know, I was like, literally uprooted, and not just in the general sense of, like, I'm a fencer here. Like, I literally had my life, like, planned out because of who I am as a robot.
That's you crazy. Know,
like, I was on track to be the editor-in-chief of the school paper, which, like, sounds really stupid and whatever, but, like, that was important to me.
Yeah.
You know, I may not have had friends, but I was going to get all the things that I wanted, that I worked really hard for.
Like, I don't
for.
Need friends.
Yeah, and they were like, oh, I know you're leaving. Yeah. And I'm like, wait, no, I worked for this thing, and you're taking it away from me. And they're like, no, you'll get it again. And I'm like, yeah, but, like, to start from zero is a lot of work when I could just, like, do one extra year, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think coming here was kind of ultimately really good in the sense that I realized there was a whole, like, non-religious world outside of hyper-Catholic Manila.
Yeah.
being surrounded by secularism was really helpful. I was given the option of going to a private school or a state school. And I'm really sorry if this sounds really bad, but this is who I was back then, and let's not shy away from that. Yeah. I said, no, I want to try to be among the people, so let's
among
go to
the people.
State school.
I love it. Oh, wow.
I so love nervous. It.
You know, I was 15 and totally gross.
I need to be with the people.
So, but no, like, that was really kind of like restorative for me to experience life outside of an affluent, like, privileged bubble.
Yeah, I remember as a kid thinking, this is a whole nother world. I was born here, but traveled back and forth between Leyte and Adelaide. And my childhood brain could not figure it out because I was like, these places cannot be any more different that I don't understand how I can go from one to the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And the religious aspect was huge. I think the line between affluent and poor being so razor thin, permanently moving from one to the other, especially at a formative age like 15.
Yeah.
That's like a potential minefield of head fucks.
And I mean, like, also because it coincided with puberty. So there was puberty, there was confronting secularism, or just like the dwindling of my own faith. Yeah. There was growing attraction to boys who could reciprocate. Yeah, to the D. And, you know, increasing contexts where you would be left alone and you could act on it. And My first boyfriend was in high school because I came out pretty soon after moving here. That's a whole other, like, traumatic story.
We'll get there.
And I feel like it all hinged on that one moment of, like, moving. Because I feel like, you know, I was dabbling back home in Manila with people. But I feel like just the way upper middle class Manila society is, you couldn't really explore it to the extent that I did here, where, you know, relatively, like, people would have been more accepting of, you know, teenage boys, like, locking your bedroom door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doing
talking.
Their thing.
Talking.
Well, as along with appearing on our show, which is probably a highlight for you.
Such a highlight.
It's right up there.
You've also appeared at numerous festivals and events, speaking about some of our favorite topics, which is race, queer identity, mental health issues is something we talk about a lot. So I'm excited for you to stick around for the whole episode to hear your thoughts on
no pressure.
Oh my God.
I know.
I'll try to be coherent.
I'm like your hype boy this episode. Ooh. But this leads on a bit from talking about the Philippines, is we have talked about intersectionality and how being a person of color can also inform how you identify in terms of your sexuality. Mm. It definitely does for myself, because the status levels are different in Manila, that you can come from being in a relatively high status position over there to you're coming to the land of the white cis gay male. How has that impacted your sort of identity?
I feel like I have two ways to approach that. One is, you know, having those identities intermingle in the one person is kind of not unique to me. You know, all of us have matrices of advantage and disadvantage, and those things kind of impact where we sit in a kind of societal context. So on the one hand, like, being I guess you would say burdened or whatever with these marginalized identities makes me on paper disadvantaged or in some way held back. And there was an interview that happened that never got published. And one of the questions was, can you detail an experience of microaggression, whether it be to do with your race or your sexuality, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yo, this is so presumptuous. I haven't experienced that thing. And on the one hand, I understand why you're asking me this because of, you know, the color of my skin and the way I present. But on the other hand, I think some of us kind of take it upon ourselves to be very good at code switching and, you know, behaving in certain ways in certain contexts. And so for me specifically, and obviously I do not speak for everybody, I think this just forms part of who I am, like maybe as a defense mechanism, I took it upon myself to know how to navigate these contexts when I moved to this country. So when I moved here, there was a lot of self-effacement that I internalized. And because I was good at, you know, I don't know, memorizing formulas at school, I was also very good at memorizing like what a white straight family, you know, a nuclear family would expect of me if I visited their house. Like this accent is the result of that process of trying to assimilate here. This wasn't my accent, obviously, when I was in Manila. It sounded more American than this. But when I moved here, I was like, no, like drop your R. Like it's a non-rotic English like speaking country. Being like, this is how you can pass as like a local in this context. There's identity on the one hand, which is static and stuff that you kind of are burdened with or yoked with. But on the other hand, there's also like how you perform those identities. That is what my essay in Mianjin hinges on. That idea, that duality between identity and performance or performativity. And this isn't my idea. Like this is an idea that's spanned like queer theory and, you know, race studies for like decades. But yeah, you hold those two together and we perform our identities in different ways in different contexts. You know, identity is performative and pragmatic rather than like static. And I feel in my case, you know, maybe I'm just really fortunate and privileged that I have the capital, I have the energy, I have the skill set to be able to be a chameleon and survive in contexts where you would expect a queer POC to not do necessarily that well. I'm not answering the question.
Well, it's such a tricky question because whenever I've been asked a similar thing, it's kind of like saying, can you pull out this little part of who you are as a whole and explain to me what that part feels like, but leave out these other things? And that's really difficult to do. No one, I think, can really comment exclusively on just how the color of their skin impacts their life as opposed to how their sexuality does or their upbringing. For a lot of us, all three of those things are one and the same.
Luke very, very briefly just touched on this before, but we delve into a lot of topics here on the show, mental health being one of the main topics that we do touch on quite a lot.
I try to sneak it in.
And
it's jazz, important.
How do you feel as like a queer community that we sort of deal with mental health? And do you feel like there's any way that we could sort of broaden things within our own community and helping others?
I think we generally do a good job of talking about it. There's a lot of, you know, visibility campaigns and awareness raising campaigns and a lot of memes especially get kind of circulated, especially on things like Are You Okay Day and I'd a Hobbit. I think those are wonderful in that they remind people that they aren't alone and that there are services that exist that they can access or tap into. I feel that maybe we don't do enough on a kind of person-to-person level. It's easy enough to tell someone, hey, maybe you should get some therapy, but to actually sit down with someone and like drive them to GP to get a referral and then to drive them to the therapist or help them find a therapist in the first place, because there are, you know, LGBTQIA plus friendly therapists, and having one is so key, I think, to the success of your therapy from my obviously small sample size of one. But I've tried like non-LGBTQIA plus therapists and they're horrible. My God. So condescending. So yeah, I can't stress how important that is. But then when someone doesn't have the time or the energy to do that, when they're in a really bad place, you know, I feel that they wouldn't really take the time to research who they can go to. Some people don't really understand how the system works in the first place. Like we have Medicare that allows you to take 6 subsidized sessions and then you can get an extra 4, for a total of 10 if the GP and or the psych deem that it's necessary. And that's huge, but not many people know that. Some people are really resistant to therapy. So I think that's definitely something that we could do better. So I think on the one hand, awareness campaigns are really good. We're doing a good job of that. But then following through is probably where we're possibly falling short.
I think it's also to know what is useful to someone that may be struggling with their mental health. One of my colleagues is pregnant at the moment, and she was complaining to me just yesterday and saying, I wish people would stop getting me fucking flowers.
Oh, they do nothing.
Like, do nothing. If someone could, like, give me a voucher for a nanny for a couple nights, that would be an amazing gift. And I said, you know what? There's this mindset that this really applies to when our friends are suffering with their mental health as well. We tend to give them a pat or lend an ear or maybe some chocolates or some flowers or whatever, when some of the most useful things you can do is, do you need your laundry done?
Yeah.
Do you need groceries done? Do you need a lift from here to there? These kind of boring, mundane things are actually so useful.
Makes such a big difference in someone's
day. And I think we have the knowledge about seeking help and that we're not alone. You know, we see these posts, but it's also about the support systems and us knowing, like, what do our friends and our family members need? They're not always the people that are going to ask for that as well. Sometimes you do need to go proactively and say, have you got on top of your chores? What can I chase up for you? Those kind of things can go a long way with mental health. But I think the queer community as a whole is one of the better communities in terms of talking.
Yeah.
There is not a more awkward situation in the world than when two people arrive to a psych practice at the same time that know each other and don't know that the other person is also seeing a psych. That can be like death to some. Yeah. But when I've seen it happen to members of the queer community, it's a party. You go here.
Hey, there you go.
It's like water off a duck's back because the conversations have already been had. So yeah, I really agree that there's some practicality is potentially the next step.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Let's dive into some open-ended queer theory.
Yes.
Huh?
Do it.
Nice. Ayo.
Well, I was thinking about this the other week, and I always like investigating my position within the LGBTQIA plus community and my prejudices and my views on it.
Yeah.
Because it's not something any of us are taught. Queer theory and our relationships to the community is something we have to figure out on our own. It can lead to us getting to an age like my mid-30s. Yeah. God damn it, that's the first time I've said that. And you can investigate and go, oh, I could be wrong about certain things.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't have the resources and the information provided to us. But something that I've always found really interesting is the interplay and the relationship that we have as members of the G and the Q to the L, B, the I, and the T. Now, a lot of people tend to see us as a harmonious movement.
You're all together. You're all friends.
And we're all together, but the reality is there's been some butted heads in
the past. Game of Thrones, bitch.
And not only have we butted heads in the past, we've also been pitted against each other in the past by outside forces. That sounded like Star Wars.
Game of Thrones.
So I just wanted to open up and talk a bit about the other letters in our acronym, how we relate to them, if we've ever felt any sort of infighting. I came from the old school. I was raised on the Are You Being Served camp, mm-hmm. you know, the worst possible stereotypes of lesbian and gay men, where they were always painted as sort of like cats and dogs. They don't
get
along, and like gay men make jokes about lesbians and lesbians make jokes about gay men. To be honest, it took a really long time to untangle those wires as I grew up to realize, no, I'm actually allowed to be friends with lesbians.
Yeah, totally.
There isn't anything chemically within me that prevents me from relating to and having a friendship and a relationship with a lesbian or a transgender person. Mm-hmm. And you have to put aside your preconceived notions, society's sort of stereotypes, as well as political forces trying to influence you in certain ways. So also a big part of it too is, you know, we say to be the best G you can be on this show. Mm-hmm. I feel like as a G quiet, silent Q.
Yeah.
We get it, the biggest slice of the pie in terms of visibility.
Yeah.
That can be a blessing and it can also be a curse.
Yes. Yeah.
And it comes with a certain privilege.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who likes lesbians, basically? That's you. Yeah.
I think it's so funny because I have kind of grown up with that. Well, I mean, in my gay career of like lesbians versus gay guys. And there's always been so many representations of that in TV, like sitcoms like Will and Grace and things like that. Jack is always going on about lesbians.
Oh,
and
yeah,
so many comedy shows I've seen. It's always pitting against each other. And I've always had that mentality. I don't have any lesbian friends. And I'm like, is this the reason why?
Yeah.
Am I stopping myself from
you're
doing
the product of all this.
Oh, God. I'm a monster. No, but I would love to have some.
Yeah,
my friend.
Great.
I saw a comedy show recently and it was a lesbian. She's referring to gay guys as like they always get deemed as the fun ones. And she was like, what about the lesbian spotlight? What about us? But I thought that was really funny because it's kind of true. Yeah. Like, we're the poster boys. And then,
totally. Yeah. And that comes down to male privilege at the end of the day as well. I think in the beginning of fighting for equal rights with like LGBTQIA plus people, sort of needed to be gay men at the forefront of it because being a man, you have more privilege than anybody else.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel like we've gotten to a point in time now where we've used that privilege in a really, really good way, especially through the HIV epidemic as well back in the 80s, that now we sort of need to like still use our privilege as men, but like I feel like a lot of the time it's we're being spokespeople for everyone else in the community, and that needs to not be the case anymore, where we use our privilege to bring everybody else up and then push them forward in front of us.
Yeah, I feel like I shouldn't be speaking on behalf of anybody, let alone the other letters.
Oh boy, there's a lot of letters.
There's a lot of articles about the LGBT community unifying for trans rights currently, which is something that I think needed to happen because they were obviously under a lot of attack from different political parties. But in the past, there has been moments where the L and the G have sold the T a bit short.
Oh yeah, for sure.
In order to get certain legislations, things like bathroom policies, for example. Yeah. And it's a huge puzzle to solve. They've had to look at it and go, how do I get rights for enough people? Mm-hmm. Like, they had to sell some of the letters.
Someone short.
Short. Yeah. I think we're at a point in time where the T is getting pushed to the front, and they're such good representations of our community as well. They're strong, they're fierce. They have important stories to share as well. That I think the more that people in positions of power can divert that limelight to say, hey, we should be listening to these people, not us anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they've got the stories that people need to hear.
Yeah, the utilitarian argument is very much like premised on, I guess, palatability. Hey, I mean, you talked about male privilege previously, and it is a fact that a cis mask gay man is less threatening to the cishet majority than, I don't know, like a person like me who's like queer and like weird and you don't quite know, you know, what that person's, like you can't easily designate that person's gender or sexuality identity. Code switching aside, like it's still like considered threatening, right? To be in any way flamboyant or just like gender bending in general. But yeah, I think the flip side of approaching things from like utilitarian perspective is that who are you actually leaving behind?
Yes.
And even just thinking from our like small example of the same-sex marriage ostensible win, that fight was argued for and the war was waged without real recourse to what the impacts would be for trans people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that should have been factored into what we were fighting for in the first place. Yeah. But because it was easier to just pick one battle, you know, for the people who were the most palatable, then we went on that road first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disregarding anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't think there's any ill will.
No, no.
In these decisions. Although I did read an article about a conference between some heads of LGBT corporations in America where they'd basically said white cis gay men are no longer discriminated against, so we need to focus on the other members. And I don't think that's 100% correct.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about it before on the show a little bit, is the addition of the Q and the identity of Q. Yeah. Because when talking about the letters in our rainbow, the one thing I kind of always go back to is this internalized homophobia that a lot of us have had and that I had for many, many years, because being broadly grouped into a category within a bunch of other categories as well, I kept seeing representations of people that did not represent me. And that led to a lot of internalized homophobia where it's like, I don't like this because if you represent the G, that's representing me too, and that's not me, and I don't like that as well. What an awful person to hang out with. I would have.
I mean, it's still pretty awful.
Yeah, I was like, what?
More palatable now.
But the addition of the Q and being able to identify as that, I think, really freed my brain up to be like, I don't have to conform to this historical view of what LGBT stands for. I can have a sexual identity separate from these concepts and maybe separate from some of that infighting and some of the expected relationships we're meant to have to the other letters. Yeah.
I think there's also so much conflict with the B, bisexual people, and especially with gay guys, and bi erasure, because people saying it doesn't exist,
it's
on your way to being
gay.
I mean, surely that is the case for a lot of people, but there are a lot of bisexual people and you can't speak for them.
At first, I thought you were talking about the B movie again.
The B you need to let it go, Luke.
Your eyes lit up, you're like, what?
Like, ooh, Pixar. It's a Pixar.
Callback.
But so we need to focus on uplifting the other letters, absolutely.
I've also found by friends of mine finding solace in the queer
bubble
as well. Yeah. For me, queer is like that boat that comes from to the deserted island. You're like, finally, like, oh my God, I can leave this shit behind and actually just have an identity of my own. So maybe that solves the problem.
I mean, that's kind of what I talk about in that Mianjin essay, which everyone should read. That idea that queer is kind of emancipatory. Like, it is. Like, it means everything and nothing in the context of, like, Western sexualities. You can be queer in terms of who you have sex with. You can be queer in terms of your gender identity. You can identify as one thing and then, like, completely change your mind the next day.
Yeah.
And for me, it's, like, the closest English term for butler. Totally. Like, for me, it's just like, I, when people ask me my gender, I'm just like, oh, well, I'm queer. And they're like, but that's not a gender. And it's like, well, it is, because I don't quite care. Like, I can be a bunch of things.
Yeah.
It's very unstable. Yeah. And that instability is what queer is. And that's what it's been reclaimed from its history, right? That it's just about weirdness or like not being conventional.
Something that I have noticed within my various groups of friends, I mean, like, I generally have a lot more female friends and a lot more like queer female identifying friends than I ever have gay men. From time to time, the conversation would sort of go toward being negative to, like, the cis gay white experience and the fact that a lot of people feel that, unfortunately, now that we are progressed as a society, that their views sort of no longer really count anymore. Yeah. And, like, they sort of feel like, well, you've represented us long enough.
Cancel.
You're done.
What you're saying now, we're going to cancel everything that you're saying, which is disheartening to a point.
Yeah.
But I can completely understand where they're coming from, whereas, like,
had their time in the spotlight.
You've had your time in the spotlight. Yeah. Enough is enough. But at the same time, you can't sort of say that their experience is invalid.
Yeah. I mean, it's still part of the community. We should all be supporting each other in that way. I don't think
not all of us are.
Yeah, it, it,
well, no, I think okay. I think as a like a very outspoken Q who likes to queer things up, I think the issue is less about the validity of opinion and more about how limited the platforms are.
Yeah.
So because the power dynamic still rests very much on the mainstream, so cisgender straight people, and they retain the positions of power to give us the platform, what they tend to do is they go to the usual suspects.
Yeah.
They go to someone who is like, who has a demonstrable track record of being able to deliver the right message, to not be too threatening, you know, who just want ruffle right feathers. They, like, they can basically pass us straight, is what I'm saying. So what happens is that the same people get asked to do the same things.
Yeah.
And because of that, that message then becomes watered down in that way because they continually get the same platforms that they're not really representative of the community as a whole. I'm going to invoke a theoretical term here. Homonormativity. Which is like, I can't remember who the theorist is, but the idea that someone who is like straight adjacent gets points from the mainstream, so homonormativity, because whether for real or not, you're representing the same kind of desires and aspirations as someone who is straight, the nuclear family, getting a job, being respectable, having like a white collar job, short hair.
It's like different, but not too different.
So like you completely like eradicate the things that are threatening about you. Again, whether you choose, whether you're choosing to or not is kind of irrelevant. It's about the perception that you receive from other people. They tend to correlate with the G, and those are the people who get the platforms. That ultimately, like collectively over time, distorts the message that we're getting out about, you know, the ongoing plights of people who are, let's say, trans, who are, let's say, still grappling with the prohibitively high costs of transitioning. You know, that's something that a G person would never, a cisgender G person would never really know about. So why would they ever talk about it? And even if they do talk about it, going back to Archer personal story stuff, it's not going to be like as empathy generating because it's not someone's actual story. It's like they're just reporting about it.
This episode's going to be airing the day before Mother's Day, so I thought we could all maybe just discuss our mothers a bit
talk about
how they've impacted our gay-ass lives. I've met your mum.
She's so awesome. I love my mum so much. She is the most genuine, lovely person in the world.
Like the 5 minutes that I saw her. That's
enough.
I got all of that.
She's such an incredible, strong woman. Honestly, like, I know, like, a lot of gay people are just like, my mom's the best, but my mom actually is
the best.
You'll fight for sure.
Like, we've been through some really hard shit in our lives, and she's always managed to muster up the strength to just pull us all through and, like, get us where we need to be. Like, we grew up in bloody poverty, like, in commission housing, as I've said before, and, like, there's been times we've been evicted from housing, and it's just so incredible now as an adult to be able to sit down with her and talk about what our lives were, because being a child you sort of just like, oh, this is just how things are, and I don't know what actually is like going on. And then actually being able to be like, hey, you know those times where like this crap thing happened or this amazing thing happened, like what was actually going
on?
What was happening behind the scenes? And I feel like our relationship has developed into us being friends rather than mother son situation, where I see her as an actual human being now.
She was like quoting the show to me.
When
mum listens every show. She was like, I know you, Luke. I was like, this
is so good.
That's dedication.
She's one of our biggest fans for sure. She likes everything on Facebook.
My mom's the biggest fan. No, my mom is actually also a very, very big fan of the show. She listens to every episode and she always messages me about like all the things we say. So it's also why I'm very scared to talk about anything sexual on the show. Hi, mom, I love you. I'm pure and haven't done anything ever.
That's a lie.
My mom lives in the UK now and she works there. And she's done very well to keep a good relationship between us because she messaged me every day on Messenger, sends me all the funny memes and everything like that. Yeah, we had kind of like a rough patch, I guess, maybe at the end of high school, I guess, when I was kind of finding my identity. And she's gotten so good with everything and she's so supportive. She fights homophobes on my Instagram comments. That story. So and yeah, she goes to like gay rallies in England. Like, I can't believe, I was like, my mom. She's so beautiful. She's like crazy good at fashion. She's not like a regular mom. She's a cool mom.
She's a cool mom.
She's such a cool. We should all post pictures of our moms on Mother's Day.
I would never.
You wouldn't?
I would never.
Oh, just do you in a wig then.
I would post pictures of JB's mom.
Yeah.
My best friend is like my surrogate or like family. Your,
yeah.
See that. Not to rag on mums on Mother's Day. What a shit thing to do.
Timing.
It's just like a very crotchety 70-year-old Catholic Filipino lady who spends like most of her time in tracksuit pants with her hands down the front of them. Yeah. Like, I love her for that.
Wait. Where do her hands go?
You'll ever see, just like get real comfortable.
Oh, just like tucked, like.
Just like tucked in the pubic area. Yeah.
Wow, that is not a Filipino thing because my mom does not do that.
I think she picked it up here in Australia.
Oh.
Wow.
And it used to embarrass the shit out of me. Yeah. She'd come in while I had JB and my friends around. I'd be like, Mom, get your fucking hands out of your vagina. Jesus Christ.
Oh, Jesus.
What would Jesus think?
Yeah. But I always think, like, both of my parents, but to a great extent, my mother was quite formulative for me in terms of my values. I think that's something that harsh Catholicism can instill. Hmm. Got a lot of guilt from that as well, which is great. I carry that around all the time.
Yeah. So gift that keeps giving.
But yeah, I think as complicated as family dynamics can be, especially in a Filipino context, that she's still my mum, and I wouldn't trade her for anyone else, or maybe Mikey's mum, because it impacts who you are and who you turn out to be. Yeah. And when you get a bit older, those conversations are lovely to talk to your parents and say, I'm the person I am, largely, in fact, for the upbringing that I received from you, the good and the bad.
That's it. Yeah, well, with my mom, we did butt heads, I guess, for like a little while, like at the end of my teens, and we would have these big blow-ups, and it was hard because I was going through a stage when I was kind of finding and trying, like, myself and trying to figure out who I was, and also, I guess, in relation to my brother, like, was that his thing? Like, what about me? Like, surely I can't kind of be gay as well, like, who has two gay children kind of thing. And there were some hard times growing up with my parents and custody battles and things like that. But looking back, my mom's been so powerful and really good. And she's like raised two kids basically all on her own. Mm. Actually, I haven't seen my mom in 2 years now, I think it's been. I have a holiday booked with her in Italy in September.
Cute.
So I'm super excited to kind of just have that time with her and reconnect and just have some really good conversations as well.
Yeah.
Like, some of the things I want to talk to her about are my current relationship, because I've entered this relationship while my mom has been away.
She doesn't... a relationship?
Yes. I never talk about it. And it's weird because it's like these two people that I'm so close with and they don't even know each other. But even though she's added him on Facebook and likes everything he posts, but I'm excited to talk to her about him. And she is very supportive in that way. She's come a long way. I remember, I don't think I've ever spoken about coming out on the podcast. I think you guys did, but I kind of have this weird distinct memory of being on MSN. And I heard her watching TV in the background, and I think it was Real Housewives? No, Desperate Housewives. I think one of the wives has a gay son in the show. I never really followed it. Mm. They had this whole big fight on the show about him being gay, and she's like, well, you never tell me anything. I just want to know something about your life. Are you gay? And then I swear to God, 5 minutes later, I just felt this like presence behind me. Like, while I was on the computer, I was like, oh God, just like sweating bullets. And I had my first boyfriend at the time. I don't know why, but for some reason, she thought he was interested in my best friend, a girl, at the time. So I just let her believe. I was like, yeah, that's why we're all hanging out together. But yeah, and she's like, that guy, he's not Ella's boyfriend, is he? And I was like, no. And she's like, is he with you? And I was really quiet and awkward. She's like, just tell me. No one ever tells me anything.
Yeah.
So I kind of just nodded awkwardly. And she's like, okay, that's fine. That's all I wanted to know. And then she just went to her bedroom and I could hear her crying. And she called her best friend who had gay children as well. And then I think they just had a really good conversation. And I remember sitting on the steps outside my house, outside her bedroom window, kind of just listening. And since then, she's come such a long way. And I'm really, really proud of her and our relationship. And I'm really excited to spend some time with her.
It's really, like, lovely hearing, like, other people's stories with, you know, their relationships with their mothers. And obviously, they're very, like, they're all quite different. Like, I would like to say that I have a Mikey-level, like, mom relationship. Yeah. That's not necessarily the case. It's fraught. I think we're okay now. I think, as is what happens when you're, you know, in your 30s and your parents kind of like ease into the fact that you're definitely your own person with your own values and stuff. I think my relationship with my mom in terms of sexuality was very much less about, you know, her finding out and more about her like finally being like, okay, cool, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. So my mom, while we were in the Philippines, she's ethnically Chinese. So there's a lot of like kind of pressure put on the male offspring, especially in Southern Chinese culture. And I think for her, she's the eldest child in her siblings. even if she's female. But so that meant like a lot of the pressure was on me. And then knowing quite at an early age that I was special, not in the gay sense, in the queer sense. Yeah. I mean, in the kind of the academic and like performancey sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were just like, this is the golden child, like literally protect him. And he will be like such a boon for our family and like passing on the thing. And then finding out that I was a little bit like off in the sense that I wasn't interested in like women and I was hanging out with women but not like hanging out with women. I think like the crystallization of that was very clear for her, like quite early on, being like, oh god, wait, you're not gonna have kids. That was like that was like the main
thing. That's a big thing for people.
So you're not gonna pass on the stuff,
this amazing gene love like success.
And then you're not gonna bring me a wife. And then the Catholic stuff came in. You know, you're gonna like doing all this sinful stuff. And so like she and dad definitely weren't O'Shea with that aspect of who I was growing up. I wouldn't call it gay conversion therapy as such, but there was an attempt to like get some spiritual intervention in my life. And I think that's possibly also why they decided to send me elsewhere in the hope that something would click or like push me back onto the so-called right path or whatever. And so like a lot of my therapy with my psych quite early on in my therapy journey was about confronting the reality that, and I had to learn to say this, was that I hated my parents like for a long time. Like that was a thing that I felt that I could never own up to. And the point when I finally had the bravery to say to her, like I was like bawling. I could barely talk. And like, you know, I'm always talking. Like talking isn't hard for me. But that was really hard for me to do. And then saying that, like there was like, I know this sounds like super cliche and fake, but like it was real. Like like something like unhinged like in my chest. I was like, yo, was like I said that thing that I needed to say. And then like as my therapist and I kept going on this kind of analysis of like my inner turmoil, like we realized that it was because my concept of, you know, we talked about like achievement earlier on in the show. It's that I only really understood like love in a conditional sense, when really like as a child what you're meant to feel is like unconditional love, and I never got that from either parent. So we're not talking about dad right now, he's a whole other thing. I love him too now.
We'll address our Father's Day.
But she was my literal soccer mom or like whatever, like my stage mom. Early on in my primary school years, she would be the one coaching me through how to win this like speaking competition or like how to win this debating thing. She was the one who would like breathe down my neck about practicing piano. For me, it was very much like, well, if I don't impress mom, she's not gonna love me,
right?
And then like knowing, bam, there's this other thing that she definitely can't love because it's apparently inherently wrong. You know, I just felt all like sorts so of kind of like naughtiness. I mean, she met that high school boyfriend, and this is the interesting thing is that I don't think she necessarily was like fighting it actively, but at the same time she wasn't comfortable with it. It's that kind of like cold tolerance of like, well, you know, you're choosing to be sinful, that's cool. It's like, but is it really cool? I don't think it is. But like over the years, you know, I came out at 16, I'm 30 now, so it's like 14 years.
You wear them down.
Look, that's a really like apt way to put it. And it's sad that that's also like an apt way to put it. But I feel like that is what's happened though, is that, you know, like part of the worry was that I wouldn't be taken seriously, or that people would make fun of me, or like I would be hurt or bashed or whatever. None of those things have happened. And if anything, I feel like me embracing this aspect of who I am has like launched like my career like so much more. And I like love myself. Like I can say that now, whereas I never could. We went to this like animal sanctuary in Phillip Island recently. We've been there before, but there was a new sign on the door where it was like, management reserves the right to kick out anybody who exhibits like attention seeking behavior, blah blah blah. And mom was like, oh my god, lol, well you can't be here. And I did this like sexy dance like display like in front of the management, like near the door. She was like, lol. And I was like, whoa, like she actually laughed at
that. That's great.
Like that is the like,
it's funny how like little moments like that can have such a big standout.
It's so stupid. Like no one else would get it, but like it meant so much for her to make a joke about my flamboyance, like my queerness. Totally. Like I occasionally like attention seek. Like that's just part of it. But like, you know, you wouldn't do that if you were like straight.
I think it's nice when you see your parents let their guards down a little bit. Like the same for me, it took a very long time for my mum to even laugh if I made a joke. Like jokes are so important to me. My whole life is a joke. I just got nothing back from my mum, and I knew this material killed. I was like, that is a good bit. There is no way you cannot laugh at this. But it did take roughly the same amount of time, like 15 years or so, that my mum now actually writes ha-ha in text messages. Yeah. And she's never done that before. But it was nice to see those layers of like Catholic stoicism kind of letting down over the years. In terms of my sexuality, I think I spoke about it last week. It's a very like American military, don't ask, don't tell. And we have that mutual respect for each other. I know she's got her life. I ain't about to go trumping in there with a bunch of shit she doesn't like. So I expect her to not do the same to me, to come trumping over here to Melbourne and slamming down Bibles and whatever. And we coexist quite happily. That said, I wasn't the perfect child. And like when I came out to mum and dad, I was off a bender of like deciding that I wanted to be a socialist. And like I was just that teenager. And like, I'm going to shave my head. And I'm really into pottery now. Like, deal with it.
Those are very different things. Like, sorry.
Well, that was like my parents' experience. Yeah. They were just like, fuck this kid. Oh, he's gay now? Like,
what's next?
They just had to roll with all of these punches. And it's taken me calming down and getting into my 30s that they've realized, oh, this one is sticking. This one's sticking. I'm not a socialist anymore. But yeah, it's nice to be on that level with her now.
So we got a little update for y'all. Because who doesn't love porn?
My mom is listening.
Last year, it was announced that Tumblr was obviously getting rid of all of their adult content as of December, and they were just going to go through periodically and be like, nah, this is not okay, and this is not okay.
And Garfield and now it's comics.
Garfield comics?
Sexy Garfield or just Garfield?
Just regular Garfield. The porn filter kept incorrectly picking up pictures of Garfield.
Yeah.
And they kept getting
like, no, naked cat, none of that.
Side note there.
This is so fascinating.
It's true.
So yeah, they've started getting
rid of Tumblr's a barren wasteland
now. I still have my Tumblr account and I check from time to time because I've got like all my saved videos and stuff, and slowly but surely they're all disappearing. I'm like, no!
Save videos of lol cats?
Yeah, all of those. No. But yeah, so Verizon, the company that own Tumblr, which is like a telecom...
They're like a phone provider.
Yeah, they're a phone provider in the States. So they've announced that they want to sell Tumblr, and Pornhub have jumped on it.
Funny.
And it's like, we want to buy this and we want to return it back to how it was.
No shit.
Yeah.
Why are they doing that? Like, strip it down to its bare bones. No one wants it. They're like, actually, let's sell it. Like,
It's like, let's get rid of this thing because it's not the one thing that was going well anymore. For you. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But I just don't think that they'll be able to take it back to what it was because, like, a lot of people have moved to different platforms.
Yeah, I'm not a big Twitter user, but when I do go on Twitter, it's quite scary. I'm like, oh, that's a lot of nudity.
I post all my Garfield stuff on Twitter. I don't like Pornhub. I don't really like the format.
No, I feel like there's too much to sift through.
I get bombarded by weird ads for like sexy CGI games.
Yeah.
To like click on tits and stuff.
Yeah.
The filter is never quite right. Like I'm clearly...
And do you think the marketing is always wrong? It's always like big breasted woman. You're like, well,
I clicked on the gay tab, but not the breast tab.
That's so it's like I clearly searched for like double breeding bareback party.
Yeah.
Like I'm not...
Clutch the pearls.
I want something. I'm a nerd as well. Like, if I'm going to watch porn, it has to be in HD.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are we talking about free porn?
Yeah.
You can't be that picky if it's free porn. I'm sorry. Like, you have to pay for that shit.
Yeah.
Well, it's led to me, like, just.
Do you pay for porn?
No. I'm happy to deal with the trash because I'm a cheap bitch. Oh. I'm going to pay for shit.
Yeah. Well, it's led to me just, like, not. Really being interested in porn anymore.
That is sad.
Yeah,
I didn't expect that.
Well, I guess like clinical depression has part to do with it as well, but mainly it's the pop-up ads and the layout. Also, there's this weird element of like danger with these streaming sites because you just get the thumbnail and the amount of times I've been catfished by like clicking on a video and then all of a sudden it's...
Viruses.
No, it's like a fisting video or it's a fetish that I'm not into that's not labeled on it.
Oh boy.
That you're like... I'm
sounding...
This is an Archer magazine. It's not curated for me, this sort of selection of streams for me to look at. Twitter is like porn for millennials as well, in that it's like 30 seconds of just like the best bits.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what it is? You go through those porn like accounts.
It's like if you want to see someone on Instagram naked, you just go to their Twitter.
Just go to their Twitter account and it's like a greatest hits album.
What is this? I live on Twitter. Like I am literally on Twitter like all the time and I never
you're
even
using
knew
it properly,
about this.
Though.
Have you got the safety filter on?
Oh no.
I don't think so.
Do you have the filter?
How do I know?
Your parental filter. Like
you have to go through your settings.
I've been missing out all this time. I mean, I never use Tumblr either. Yeah. I just live on Twitter. I'm horrified.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I will fix this on the way home. Just check this out.
Do any of you guys pay for porn or anything?
Nah.
I was chatting to, I think, Tom last week, and he's telling me about a friend of his that is always complaining complaining about being poor, and then finds out that he's subscribed to like a lot of like OnlyFans accounts.
Oh my God.
And then he complains about being poor, and then he's actually like, subscribed to all this porn.
Yeah. OnlyFans. Who pays for porn?
OnlyFans is becoming
days.
So big.
I feel like I should just start. One,
it's an inevitable.
Let's start a Gaze Rolling one.
Yeah. Well, have you seen Now Apocalypse?
I want to watch it.
Oh, it is so good. I will just say that there is a character who has. Yeah. I don't know if it's not. So
it's like an adjacent.
Similar. Yeah. Well, you're going to do it anyway. Camming, yeah. And it's like, why, if you're going to cam, if you're happy to be all like exhibitionist, like by all means, like monetize it. And then you have some spare cash.
Make them coin.
Yeah. And you can pay for your own porn if you want to. Like, I don't know. I will say, Luke, that there are versions of these streaming sites with the thumbnails where you can see it like moving.
I like those ones. Actually.
So those are my fave ones. Yeah. So I use xhamster.com. Okay. This is like not an advertisement.
We are not endorsed by xhamster.com.
But I'm just saying, and the filters are pretty good on xhamster. Yeah.
But I do like those thumbnails that move when you scroll over it because it reminds me of the paintings in Harry Potter.
Is that Albus Dumbledore? No, it's a giant dick.
Well, that is a wrap once again, guys. Good to see you all again this week.
It's been alright.
Thank you so much, Mikey.
Oh, you're so welcome. No, all good. Thank you so much, Adolfo, for coming and joining us.
Yeah, it was lovely.
It's been really, really nice. If people want to find you online, where can they?
Not on Tumblr. Yeah. And a totally G-rated. No, it's probably like MA15 plus. Twitter, and Instagram. I'm on @Adolfo_AE, or if you Google Adolfo Melbourne, I feel like I'm probably the only person that comes up.
Yeah,
yeah.
I also have a website. You can go to AdolfoRunwears.com.
Nice.
I'm online.
Awesome.
I'm online.
I'm around. thanks for having me, Lol.
No, thank you so much for being here. It was a blast.
Thanks for classing up the episode.
Yeah,
classing up.
In the mix.
Don't forget to follow us on our socials on Facebook and Instagram @GazeRevoltingPod.
We also have some very exciting news coming up that we're going to announce, so stay tuned on our socials about a second live show here in Melbourne. So stay tuned. The first one was lit.
Yes, it was.
And you don't want to miss out on that
this
opportunity.
One will be
it's sold out, actually. It's sold out.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things you actually have to buy tickets to.
Yeah. Oh, you miss out. So
oh, yes.
You
miss out.
on all of this.
Thanks again, y'all. We'll see you all next week.
Yeah, we'll
Happy Mother's Day.
Great.
Happy Mother's Day.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.